We all owe them, but very few of us know them. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities. And these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Welcome to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia.
You know, silencers are legal in 41 states. If you're considering the advantages of getting a silencer, visit our friends at silencercentral.com. They'll handle all the paperwork and ship directly to your door. Silence made simple. Silencercentral.com.
The Distinguished Flying Cross Society is a nonprofit dedicated to honoring, preserving, and teaching and publishing the history and traditions of the men and women who have been awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. They're based in San Diego, California, and here at American Warrior Radio, we're very proud to be partnering with them, kind of an educational partnership. Today, we're going to talk with a member of a Navy squadron that was stood up in Vietnam specifically to address a particular need at a particular time in a particular place. And just as soon as the war ended, they were dissolved. They were known as the Sea Wolves, and they became the most decorated Navy squadron of the war. Our guest today was part of building that Sea Wolves reputation. He served 4 tours of duty in Vietnam and was awarded more than 40 medals and citations, including the Distinguished Flying Cross and the Silver Star. His first book, Sea Wolf 28, received a 5-star review from the Military Writers Society of America, and his second book, Sheepdogs, received a first-place gold medal from the Branson Stars and Flag Book Awards. You can learn more about his illustrious career. Visit combatsar.com. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Al Hollywood Billings.
How you doing?
I'm just terrific, sir. I'm really looking forward to our chat today. I tell you, you know, I mentioned our educational partnership with the Distinguished Flying Cross Society, and your story, Al, it sounds like fiction. With all due respect, but holy cow.
Yeah, that's why when you go through the book, there's all kinds of documentation in it. And I know a couple of people said it sounded like the fiction. I've got over 600 reviews on the thing and 500 on Amazon, and the rest of them were personal reviews. I don't know what to tell you. It was crazy. The Silver Star, it did get in the Navy Times. In fact, they were going to take my wings away with the Silver Star, and it got in the Navy Times. So the CEO said, you know, give them a damn medal.
Get him out of here. Well, I was not challenging you. And we're going to share those stories with our listeners today, so I hope they'll stick around. Now, a little bit about you. Technically, would you qualify as a Mustang?
I that's a fine point. I enlisted in the Navy. And they had I got in one of the last years of the Naval Aviation Cadet Program, where you didn't have to have a degree. So you went through not quite 2 years of flight training in it the whole time. And if you made it all the way through, you got your wings in commission on the same day. If you didn't make it through, you were out in some ship in the Pacific chipping paint.
Mm-hmm. Now, what year was this that you enlisted?
I enlisted in 1964.
So not a lot happening in Vietnam at that point in time yet.
No, in fact, probably one of the reasons why they kept us, we're loading up on that, though. I think the war was just starting to build up, so they were bringing a lot more people in. But out of our class of about 90, there was probably less than 10% that were NAFCADs. The rest of them were all college graduates, so we had to hustle a lot.
Yeah, I would bet. Now, where were you? You're in the Navy. You got your wings. Where were you when that call came out for volunteers to form this new squadron?
My first tour was with HC-1, and I was in Yankee Station. I had trained for Combat Search and Rescue, and HC-1 was the oldest Combat Search and Rescue squadron in the Navy. In fact, Bridges of Toko Ri, that was HU-1, which became HC-1 later on. So it's a long history, over 1,700 rescues in combat and civilian rescuers on the thing over the years and stuff. So when I was finishing up that cruise, what happened is I ended up, when I trained for combat search and rescue, somebody got sick on one of the carriers, and I was taking that because I was a brand new ensign. I was one of the youngest guys, and they said, you're going here instead of the combat search and rescue off the cruisers. They had cruisers and destroyers out there that had single-plane search and rescue helicopters that went into North Vietnam to pick up the pilots. So I did tour on the Bonhomme Richard, and at the end of it, I put in for HAL 3 when he came back, and when we got back from the cruise, we flew in formation and all taxied up and landed, and the CO and the XO met us out there, and the squad on the XO shook my hand. He says, "Congratulations, you got orders to Vietnam." Ironic, there was four or five other people that put in for HAL 3 and our detachment, and I was the only one that got accepted. Don't ask me why.
Well, I think it's important to emphasize that everybody, particularly when you hear the incredible types of mission that you all were flying, everybody there was a volunteer. And so I think the first group was, probably about 80 people, if I can believe the internet?
Yeah, it was actually a detachment from HC1 that they went out there. They were a quick reaction force, and we had everybody was instrument trained. They were in the Navy, and the Army didn't have any night training. Most everything happened on the bad weather and nighttime. That's when Charlie liked to do most of his mischief. And they were called Rowell's Rats, and it was HC1 Detachment 64 or whatever it was. While they were there, just as they were getting ready to switch out after their year tour, then HC1 or HAL 3 was raised up and put together, and it was commissioned in Vietnam, and their main portion of it was down in Vung Tau, South Vietnam.
Al, speaking of names, your call sign, Hollywood, is there a family-friendly story behind that?
And developed later on, and I was actually my call sign with the Seawolves was Seawolf 2-8. I was the detachment 2. I was the most junior officer. We had 8 pilots, and I was the 8th pilot, so I was Seawolf 2-8. It was later on in the Navy I picked up the moniker. They started calling me that. It's a long story in the book, but I was sort of a character, and the more I was a character, I wore sunglasses and smoked a cigar, and the troops seemed to like that. I didn't take any crap from anybody, and the more I acted up, the more the troops liked it and the harder they worked. So it was sort of a team, and it carried on for basically the rest of my career. So.
Let's talk a little bit about the Seawolves. You were, if I got this correct, basically you were formed to provide support for Navy special warfare, in effect the SEALs, and the riverine forces, the brown water Navy, and then pretty much anything else that came up. You guys knew this when you were getting into it, that that's what you're going to be doing? Or did they kind of tell you that later?
No, it was a combination of two different types of people. There were some of them that needed the check mark for career to be in the combat zone. I myself is a young 23-year-old. By that time, I just gotten JG on my second tour. I was there to find out who I was because I was going to the airlines. So I didn't really care about the medals or anything. I was on a search to find out who I was and how I would respond to those situations. Some of them, the career guys, were out there for a ticket punch on the thing. They were willing to risk, doing what they wanted on the thing. So. No, I was a bit of a character. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't a troublemaker, but I didn't, as a junior officer, I gave the senior officers a headache. In fact, a friend of mine, I got years later, he says, one of your favorite sayings I really liked, because I used to tell seniors, the only way you could hurt me with that fitness report is roll it up into a tube and jab me in the eye.
Well, I tell you what, Al, based on the next couple of stories we're going to tell, I mean, your specialty was disregarding orders. We'll get back to that one more when we come back after this break. Ladies and gentlemen, Ben Buehler-Garcia, we're talking with Al Hollywood Billings. He was awarded both a Distinguished Flying Cross and a Silver Star for missions that were only 30 days apart. You'll hear more about that when we come back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Al Hollywood Billings. Al flew 4 tours of duty in Vietnam, and he was a member of a group called the Sea Wolves. If you hadn't heard of them, you can find some stuff about them with Al himself on the History Channel and some other things. They were a very specialized group, the Helicopter Attack Squadron Light 3, that were there to support Navy Special Warfare and Riverine Forces in Vietnam. Al, what kind of aircraft did you fly in this group? Was it all? It wasn't all just UH-1s, right?
Yeah, it was all UH-1s. They were the B models and the C models. It was an interesting story on that. Is what had happened is the Navy traded P-2s to the Army, and the Army gave them used Hueys. And it started out with the Bravo model. In the last part of the tour, they switched over to C models. And most of them had over 6,000 hours on the airframe when we got them. So thank God the Navy was good at maintenance and repairing things.
What is the maximum number of hours that were recommended on that airframe?
I have no idea.
Okay.
But the Huey was real workhorse, and they just patched them up and kept them going and things. So.
I saw at our local museum here, the Pima Air and Space Museum, I think it's the second largest privately owned military museum in the country, and just I was out there for a fundraiser the other night with my wife, and there was what I believe to be a UH-1 on display. Now, that helicopter had both the rocket pods and the door guns, but then it also had what I would call mini guns. Was that something that you all had, or that come later?
No, we didn't have mini guns. That came later on. The lead ship had a .50 caliber in it, and that was an impressive piece of equipment. It could tear up some things. And it had the M60s over on the other side, 2 M60s on the mounts, and then the gunner had an M60. And the wing ship, it had twin .30 caliber machine guns. And those kids could, they could make them sing. They would put one, they had a ammo box, and they could start one and sequencing that and start firing that one, and then when that one went out, even then they offset it, and then they'd start be firing the other one, and then when that one went empty, they could keep them going. They knew how to pick them up and get the cans in there and still keep them firing. It was amazing what they did with those equipment. And then we had the rocket pods, 7 on each side for a total of 14 rockets. Back then, before all of these other helicopters came out, we were probably one of the meanest guys in the land. We felt pretty positive and went out looking for trouble sometimes.
And the reason I ask that question is it just strikes me as a dumb civilian that your only forward-firing weapon at that time were your rockets, which was serious. But in other terms, you would have to sort of expose yourself to the broadside, or because you were moving and so fast and laying down so much that it didn't matter that much.
It really didn't matter. We had what we called chicken plates. It was a ceramic plate that we put in before our straps, and the seats were armored. But the crewmen did not have seats armored back there. And what they did is they took one of the chicken plates and they sat it down. The big thing was getting shot in the ass as it came through there. But the rest of the helo, the structure of the helo and stuff like that, it didn't stop anything.
Yeah, you described it as sort of like a BB gun in an aluminum can. You hear it going through, and you hope somebody wasn't in the way.
I was asked that when they interviewed for one of the books they put me in, and I knew civilians would be in it. That was the closest thing that I could come to having people that hadn't been there been exposed to it. I'm sure everybody's shot something into a BB can, either a 22 or so. I figured that was the closest thing to be able to describe it, and I think that pretty well describes.
Now, Al, were you and your teammates there with the Sea Wolves, were you flying off of ships or from ground bases or both?
There was 9 detachments out there, and I think about 3 of them had LSTs that they flew off of, and the rest of them were land-based.
Let's talk a little bit about that first mission that I want to bring up, the October 8, 1968, the mission for which you were awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. Now, as I understand it, you were all in an encampment along with some of the special forces. You were kind of bivouacked together?
Yeah. There's some crazy stories in the book. I got to be quite good friends with the SEALs. In fact, they even used one of their insertion boats, and we went skiing down the river there right in front of Nabe. Nabe stuck out on a point on the shipping channel there. We I went skiing a couple of times until the CEO of the base found out about it. In fact, one of the SEALs, he would put up a little flag and hooked it there to where he could hold it up when he was skiing down there. Then until the CEO found out about it, he cut us out. And we went over to the O Club with they had especially the two JGs that were part of the unit that on Na Bay there, and we became quite good friends, did some crazy things. And when they came over, said they needed support in this mission. There was no question, as far as I was concerned, except it was against squadron policy because you weren't supposed to go into a combat, into a situation like that with one single bird. Because if you went down, there was nobody there to support you, nobody there to call for help, nobody there to mark your position or anything. So it was pretty much squadron policy not to do that. So when I told the ONC, the SEALs came in and asked me for the help. And, of course, I was going to go. And everybody, we had four crewmen and four pilots. Everybody volunteered to go. And we got the four in the lead ship. Went out, and I told the ONC at the time, and it was an interesting story. I think he read about that. He said, "You're not going. It's against squadron policy, and you're not going." Then he turned around, walked out the door, didn't even let me get, didn't even let me answer. And I think he knew I was going to go anyway. And he was clear. He had told me that I couldn't go, so it was a done deal.
Yeah, I kind of got the impression from reading that segment that there was sort of an understanding, an unstated understanding, not necessarily a wink and a nudge, but he knew that from your reputation, but also, it was important. And my understanding is that the SEALs, that was the only night they could run this mission. The tides were right, the moon was right, and so they had to go that night. But as you mentioned, your policy was you can't go up with just one ship, and so you kind of just said, let's see if they call, and boy, they sure did.
They had three wounded, if I remember right, and they were cut off from their insertion boats, and they couldn't get back to it, so they needed some help. And unfortunately, they were over between 10 and less than 15 minutes away, just right over the thing in the T-10 area where they were in. So we could get to them pretty quickly.
What? And I know it was a very dark night, so you probably couldn't see much, but they're getting lit up. They've got some wounded. You and your crew come up over in your UH-1, and when they start shooting at you, that kind of gives away their position, right? So that gives you at least a place to fire.
Yeah, it worked out. I don't think people really understood it because not many people were in that situation. In fact, when I've been asked to go to the Rotary Wing Weapons School in NAS Fowler, Nevada, and speak to the graduating classes there, and they said they don't know how we even flew back then without night vision goggles. But yeah, it got pretty dark. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face when you took off, so it was interesting to see what was going on. But when you go in there with a single ship, and the formation, usually when you're in a combat situation at night, the lead ship has its lights on. Rotators can keep track of it and keep formation on it when we're doing attacks and stuff.
Al, hold that thought. We're going to have to get back to that right after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, Ben Buehler-Garcia talking with Al Hollywood-Billings. And rumor has it that Al had said that flying on ice like that into the heat of danger, he thought that was better than sex. We'll learn more about that when we come back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. Shooting with a silencer is not just safe for your hearing and also can make it more enjoyable, too. Visit our friends at silencercentral.com to find out if owning a silencer is legal in your state. Then work with their experts to identify the best silencer for your gun and what needs to be done to complete the paperwork. They even have financing. They'll ship directly to your door once approved. Visit silencercentral.com. We're back with Al Hollywood Billings as part of our education partnership with the Distinguished Flying Cross Society. We're talking about a mission that took place on October 8th, 1968 in Vietnam. Al was flying with the Sea Wolves. And Al, we're talking about how your reputation was that if people needed you, you were going to be there. You had built a golden reputation amongst those those people on the ground. And this is one of those scenarios where you weren't supposed to go. You violated orders, but they needed you, so you flew out with one ship when you should have had two. And did the Viet Cong not know that when they shot at you using tracers that that was a direct string line right back to where they were, or they didn't care? They were just that fanatical.
I don't think they cared that much. It was just the nature of the beast back then. It was a sort of it was funny way to go. They didn't know where they were shooting unless we were shooting. They were sort of shooting randomly. They were shooting at the sound like that because our lights were off. They couldn't see us, and it was a very, very dark night. And the only time we could do it, you know, they could see us, is when we started shooting. So it was sort of give and take type of things. And I kept on maneuvering and coming in at a different direction on them. But to add to the thing that you said, you scramble at night is better than sex. I think this is a way it came out in the books that they interviewed me on. It was almost better than sex. It was just, it was your sense of hearing, your vision, everything is super exaggerated on the thing. And your adrenaline's going, and you're scrambling, you're running, get a helicopter and get airborne. And it was just amazing that it seemed to me everything was super enhanced. And that's what I tried to mean.
Well, y'all are over this battle right now. I assume pretty soon your bingo ammunition, you have to return to refuel and rearm. And there are some Army medevacs that are going to be coming in there to actually pull these SEALs out of the field, but they weren't there yet. So you went back, you rearmed, and then right as you're coming back in, it kind of reminded me of that scene in We Were Soldiers, if you've seen the movie, where the medevacs are coming in and they're taking fire and they say, you know, forget this, and they bugged out. But, I mean, in essence, you kind of took them by the hand and said, look, yeah, it's a little hot down there, but follow me in and you'll be okay. Or is that oversimplifying the situation?
I can't remember the exact words, but they started in and they started taking fire and they pulled off. You know, and they said, we were taking fire. And I don't know whether it was a suggestion or what. They said, why don't you follow me in? And I light the place up, because we had just rearmed again. So we were fully, you know, we were fully armed again at that time. And I lit the place up on that side where they were taking the fire, because I was circling around. I could see where they were taking the fire from. And so I led them in, and they followed me in. And by the time they got to the ground, I'd pulled off and came back around, and I was able to come back in again as they were pulling out and taking off, and they didn't take any hits on the thing. So
eventually all the SEALs got out, and how many wounded? Three, four?
They said they had three wounded, if I remember right, and they're a phenomenal group of people. I mean, a little bit crazy. I've worked with them quite a bit. In fact, when I became CEO of HC1, we had the West Coast Combat Search and Rescue Swim School, and we had, I think, eight Navy SEALs that was their shore duty tour. They're the ones that ran the school, and they ran those kits through everything and things. So they're quite unusual. But, I mean, even with the wounded down there, stuff like that, one of the first comments was when I started taking fire, they said, you're taking fire. And I said, these guys are trapped down there and wounded, and they're worried about me taking fire. So I said a lot about their character.
Yeah, well, you were their lifeline, too. So Al Billings violated a direct order from the officer in charge. You kind of probably suspected that even though you'd done the right thing, you're going to get your bottom chewed. But luckily, apparently the SEAL team commander got to your officer in charge before he could get to you, huh?
Well, not the officer in charge. He called the CO directly. We had a commanding officer down in Buntao, and that was where a lot of the senior officers were. And he called the CO to thank him for getting his men out of there. And then he called the ONC and said, the guy's hard-headed, but he's a damn good pilot, but he should be reprimanded instead of getting a medal. They decided it was a DFC instead.
Well, again, that's why I say this is almost like something out of a Hollywood movie, which I guess is appropriate given your later call sign. So just an amazing story. The next one, literally, it looks like from what I can tell, Al, literally 30 days later, November 8th, 1968. And if folks don't know, the Silver Star is our third highest decoration for valor in combat that can be awarded. And in this case, involved some people called PBRs, which are basically river patrol boats. And it's important for people to know before you get into this story, those boats are about 32 feet long, about 12 feet wide, and your helicopter weighs about 9,000 pounds, and that will become an issue later in the story. But sort of set the scene for us, Al, about what started to happen there on November 8th, 1968.
Well, the sequence of events, one of the things you have to understand is you train the pilots, and there's four positions on the seat on the pilots. One is the fire team leader, who's supposed to be the most experienced, and the next senior one is the aircraft commander of the wing ship. And number three position is the co-pilot on the lead ship. He handles all of the maps and stuff like that, the navigation. And the nugget is usually the new guy who's sitting in the co-pilot seat on the wing ship. So they sort of rotate through, and when we train them, and sometimes, even though I was one of the most junior men on the detachment, because I was still only 23 or 24 years old, and even though I was the most junior, I had the most experience, and I had the most experience as a fire team leader. But when we went on, when the operations officer said, "Where do you want to sit?" because I was senior, and if I was getting ready to leave country, and the operations officer said, "Where do you want to sit?" and I said, "Hey, you know, Tim wants to get his aircraft commander, you know, let him get some experience." And I had trained Tim the whole time he was there. I said, "Just put me in the nugget seat and I'll ride along with him." Because we were going out on another mission. It wasn't until we started to take off that we got called on this mission here. So the position on the thing is the fire team lead is in charge, and the aircraft commander, the way the Navy works it, is the aircraft commander is completely in charge, and he has the last say-so of anything that happens in that aircraft. Even if there's a senior officer aboard, he's supposed to have, of course, then the politics get in, depending on how senior the officer is and what he wants him to do, whether the aircraft commander gets on there. In fact, I'm not even sure that if I was junior to Tim, I don't know, because he was an officer, and I was, you know, I went through the NAVCAT program, didn't get commissioned until I went to the fleet, so... we took off, and we were going on H&I probably, or just going around to see what's happening. You know, harassment and interdiction sometimes. When we got briefings from them, say there's been some movement there and stuff like that, and we go in and try to cause some trouble. But just as we took off.
Let me interrupt for a second there, Al. We've got about a minute for the next break, but did you just go up looking for trouble, just trying to dare someone to shoot at you on occasion?
Sometimes we did. Sometimes we'd go in, you know, there was some designation and stuff like that. They said there's a movement out there and stuff like that. And, we went out there looking around, and we called them what they called as H&I strikes, harassment and interdiction.
Okay. All right. Let's take a break here. I want to come back and get to that Silver Star mission. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Al Billings as part of our partnership with the Distinguished Flying Cross Society. Their mission is to communicate these stories of heroism so that nobody ever forgets. Don't forget, you can find over 400 podcasts at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. The most recent episodes can be found on your favorite streaming platform, iHeart, Spotify, Amazon, Google, wherever it might be. You can find us there. And please, please share these important messages. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Al, call sign Hollywood Billings, about two missions that he flew in Vietnam, one of which he was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. The mission we're talking about today took place on November 8th, 1968, and ended up being a Silver Star award to Al. Now, Al, so you're going up, as in effect, it's kind of sort of a training mission. Now, you just left the tarmac when you heard this call, or were you going? It wasn't clear to me if you were going back to refuel at that time, but what was the status of your team when you first heard that call?
You could think of it was more like a patrol or a harassment and interdiction. In other words, we flew patrols around the area, you know, we covered, and if there were any movement. There were some certain areas like the T-10 area and stuff that there was nobody was supposed to be moving in there, any sandpans or anything. And, you know, we'd sink them if we got a clearance to go ahead and do it. And I saw some of them were some free fire zones, but usually we had to get approval from the Tactical Operations Center. Let me just say, the reason that I wrote Seawolf 2-8 is I was interviewed. I've been interviewed for 3 books of some of the, what we're talking about here. And the reason I did is I had about a 3-hour interview with the first book in Fire from the Sky. And like about halfway through when we were talking about it, I said, now, do you want the truth or you just want the award version? Because I broke every rule in the book. And the basically 2 stories, they couldn't write that in the award version of the thing. And he says, oh, no, he says, I just want the award version. So that's what sort of started me on deciding to write Seawolf 2-8 is because people don't get the truth. They get a version of the truth. So some people think my book is very controversial because it is, you know, a very outspoken, this is the way I saw it type of thing.
Well, I'd echo that. I mean, frankly, the true version is a lot better, and this is certainly in this case, Al. So, yeah, thanks for sharing that. Now, in this case, it was an extraction. These 2 patrol boats, river patrol boats, were sent in to provide cover for an extraction. My understanding is they had gotten the ground troops out, and then the 2 river boats were caught in what is described, what I see as a pretty darn well-executed and planned ambush. The lead patrol boat took 2 rocket-propelled grenades right off the bat, wounded all the crew, pretty much put the captain out of action. Now, was this in daylight?
It was in daylight, broad daylight. But it was in a bad area. The T-10 area was, I mean, there was supposedly intelligence said there were several battalions down there. In fact, one time we went down there with doing Agent Orange and stuff like that, you could start seeing some coaches down there. They discovered a whole small village down there underneath the triple canopy, and they even had a hospital under there.
So what did you see when you approached this? Because it sounds to me like this was just the firefight of all firefights. At least one of the boats was pretty much already out of commission, and that's the scene that you and your compatriots fly up on.
The ONC, you know, in all fairness to him, they were usually lieutenant commanders. I went through 4 or 5 of them. They only spent about 3 months on the detachment, and then they would move back to Wang Tao, and they would rotate the lieutenant. So we had one of the newer guys. He was a nice guy. He's real quiet. He was mild-mannered, but he wasn't that experienced. And we got there, and he was circling around trying to make a decision what's going on. And since I'd had plenty of experience, I said, come on, we got to get down there. And you have to understand, one of the boat captains was on the radio, and you're wearing a helmet, and you're getting it blasted into both ears. He's yelling, he's under fire, and shooting up the place, all over the place, and he's basically saying, you know, my buddies are dying in front of me. So that can get your heart really racing on things. So as we circled around, nothing was happening. I told him, I said, we got to get down there, and we got to get down there and help them. So he just kept circling around, and I said, that's it. I said, I'm going down.
And this is where the official story departs from the true story. I'm guessing you had asked for permission to go down there and provide support, and you were ordered not to. That was denied, and you decided, once again, good old Al, to disregard those orders because you were not going to let anybody die on your watch.
That was sort of my attitude. I mean, we were there. That was our mission. That was the mission, you know, in all of HC1. That's what we sort of live by, is leave no man behind on the thing. I was just young. I grew up. John Wayne was my idol. So that tells you a lot right there. So
I want people to be able to get this because we are running a little bit out of time here, Al, but in effect, I mentioned the size of the patrol boat. I mentioned the weight of the helicopter. You mentioned there was no, we're in the middle of these little rivers with jungle on either side, so there's no landing zone. So what you did is you literally put the skid of your helicopter down on this patrol boat that was adrift at that point in time, and you know, I'm guessing the prop wash is causing the boat to want to spin, but you're sort of holding it in place with your skid under fire while one of your door gunners jumps into the boat and removes these two seriously wounded people. I mean, that just sounds, again, Al, like something out of a movie, but I guess you're not really thinking about it when you do it, or...
I was very lucky back then when basically the hit the fan, everything went in slow motion with me, and everybody responds differently to it, and I was too focused on what I had to do. You know, even when the ONC or the fire team leader told me not to go down, you know, he says, that's a direct order. I think that's the last thing I heard on the thing because I was too focused on figuring out what was going to happen, what we were going to do. So I came in, laid down the rockets on one side, and came up over, laid down the rockets on the other side, and then went right directly into the stranded boat that was there. And the rotor wash from the helicopter is about, 80 knots. And the helicopter is 42 feet long, and the PBR is a fiberglass boat that's only 31 feet long. And so it was a little bit delicate process, and I had to keep completely focused on touching the boat. If I pushed down, it came down too hard, then I could possibly tip the boat or slide off of it. And if I didn't keep the contact well enough, I could slide away from it and just end up chasing the boat around all over the place. So it was a challenge.
I tell you, another amazing part of the story is you knew that you were going to have to load up those two sailors, so you had to get rid of some weight. And, I mean, literally, as I understand, when you're kind of take off again, the nose of your aircraft is in the water. I mean, you're almost flying a helicopter / boat.
We literally settled into the water, and about the water was in about the chin bubbles, probably half foot to a foot before the cushion took over and I was able to hold it there. But now we couldn't get airborne because the chin bubble filled full of water too, so we were even heavier than when we tried to do it. So after I slid off the PBR, so I said, well, we're not staying here. Charlie's could be setting up in a different position to get an angle at us. And let me add one thing. People say, wow, this is interesting. Once we went in, the lead ship had a 50 caliber on it, and the other PBR that was making gun runs in front of us to try to protect us, because I told them when I went in, I told both of them, I said, once I get down there, when I say go, I want you to make a high-speed gun run. And so we had a helicopter with a 50 caliber reading down on Charlie, and they had the PBR with twin 50s, and they had also had M60s on that. They were fairly well-armed, and he was making gun runs on it, and I figured if it took over 60 seconds for us to make this pick up, you know, we were just sitting ducks after that. So yeah. We went on the water. I said, I'm not staying there. So we actually were like a boat as we headed downstream with the current headed towards the ocean. And I was able to pull in a little bit power as we got a little bit faster. There's this thing called translation lift on a helicopter. And so a lot of times, depending on the type of helicopter is, it's anywhere from 10 to 15 knots. And if you can get 10 to 15 knots, that translational lift that actually costs or requires less power to fly as long as you got the forward even.
Al, I tell you what, just truly amazing story. And I encourage people to grab your book, Seawolf 28, learn more about it, or maybe just Google you on the History Channel. Thank you for spending your time with our listeners today, Al.
Okay. Yeah, I hope you've got what you're looking for.
That's great stuff. Our listeners are all about hearing stories, and you're one of the best. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you to the Distinguished Flying Cross Society for also setting this up. You can learn more, visit dfcsociety.org. Until next time, all policies and procedures will remain in place. Take care.
Listening to American Warrior Radio. Archived episodes may be found at AmericanWarriorRadio.com or your favorite podcast platform.